Welcome to New Books in Film. I am your host, Joel Cherney. In the not-too-distant future, next Sunday AD, is the first line of the theme song for Mystery Science Theater 3000. The series began as a local Minnesota TV show and ran for 10 seasons through 1999 and is still immensely popular. Chris Morgan is a writer who specializes in 90s pop culture and wrote the book The Comic Galaxy of Mystery Science Theater 3000, 12 Classic Episodes and the Movies They Lampoon, published by McFarland in 2015. Chris talks with me about his personal interest in the series, as well as the film's MST3K Rift. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Chris Morgan. Hi, Chris. Thanks for talking to me today.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Most of the authors I interview wrote academic works on film topics, so I'm always happy to talk to what we might call a quote-unquote popular author. Of course, there's already been academic books and conferences that dealt with MST3K. But let's start with some background information. I know you have your own podcast, Existential Parachute Pants, but can you give me some details about your writing and other activities?
Sure. You mentioned, I'll start where, you gave me a list. Lead in there to talk about Existential Parachute Pants, a 90s pop culture podcast, which is the podcast I do, which has, in terms of writing, a corresponding sort of blog about 90s pop culture that I've done, where for almost 2 years now I've written a daily post in some way about 90s pop culture, usually fairly light, I sometimes quite short. It's just, just a thing I want to do, sort of a counterbalance to the rising sort of ironization and nostalgia of 90s pop culture, to treat it more, not necessarily seriously, but to actually treat it with at least some sort of depth and substance. And because I do a lot of sort of pop culture stuff, other writing that I do, I write frequently for the website Paste Magazine about TV and things of that nature. I've done some movie review sort of things as well. And I've written about sports also for several years, fantasy sports and so on and so forth, and other sort of writing projects here and there. I'm a bit of a writing dilettante who likes to just do various different things, if only just always have something to be sort of working on.
So I'm going to assume that I don't know if it makes a difference as far as your age is concerned, would you say you grew up in the 90s?
Yeah, it was all sort of childhood for me, which is why it helps that the person that I do the podcast with, my friend Seth Macy, is a bit older than me. So he, for the 90s, was a time of teenagerdom, early adulthood, where for me it was young childhood into teenagerdom. I have gone back and seen a lot of things from the 90s in terms of pop culture. I've always sort of, when I was a kid in the 90s, and I was watching Nick at Night and watching shows like Bob Newhart, and also when I was six, my favorite show was Dragnet, which now as an adult I find to be sort of inexplicable. But so I've always had never had an issue sort of looking back in terms of pop culture. But yeah, the 90s for me was sort of a time where I didn't necessarily have a real sort of understanding of pop culture other than a sort of a limited sort of bandwidth of what a child has access to, particularly at a time pre sort of internet, where now, a child could get to sort of any sort of pop culture that they could sort of conceive of. But, but it's sort of more reflective. And the reason it's the 90s more than anything about my childhood or anything is because the 90s, I realized, is becoming what the 80s had been, the natural progression of time. And I would want to sort of, get out ahead of that, as I watch sort of a renaissance in terms of actual sort of a more substantive contemplation of sort of 80s pop culture. I wanted to sort of get ahead of that in terms of 90s pop culture while it was becoming what the 80s was, so to speak.
Yeah, I think sometimes it seems like some of the cable stations seem to be living almost completely on episodes of Friends and Seinfeld, which are both 90s television shows, and in the past, as you point out, it was the 80s and so on and so forth. So it's like they're trying to aim towards people like you who grew up with at that period of time and might want to go back and relive or revisit some of these pop culture materials and television and so on. So I guess it's not a surprise that Mystery Science Theater 3000 would be an important part of your interests, given that it's almost its entire life was in the 90s. Could you just explain, for anybody who might not know, but what the background of the show was and what was your personal experience as a viewer? How did you come to the show?
Sure. Well, the show was, it's sort of a very sort of unique thing, which are the parameters of pop culture. It was a show, it originated in Minnesota, in the Twin Cities area, as a way of like, you know, because this was like a UHF station back in the day when like there was less sort of things going on in the world of sort of television, and they were showing like, you know, the cheapo sort of movies, monster movies and horror movies that, you know, were sort of a quintessential sort of things they would show on those sort of stations because they could block out a lot of time. And a guy named Joel Hodgson had an idea to sort of spruce this up a bit, and they created a show where he and a couple of robots were in outer space, and they would watch these movies, and they would make sort of comments and quips and jokes while watching the movies, and they were usually bad movies, so they could make fun of them, and also they would have little sort of host segments in between to take people in and out of commercial breaks, and then that went to Comedy Central, where it lasted for several years, and gained enough popularity, enough of a cult following to have a movie come out, although by that point Joel was no longer with the show and had been replaced by Mike Nelson, who had been the head writer for the bulk of the show's run. And then it moved to Sci-Fi Channel, which is where I first found the show. As a kid, was on the Sci-Fi Channel, where it ran for three more seasons, but with a different cast and bear at the beginning. So it was sort of interesting to me because, like, when I found the show, Mystery Science 3000, it was the show with Mike as the human in space, and the mad scientists, sort of ostensible villains of the piece were Pro Forrester, Bobo, and Professor Bobo, and a brain guy. Whereas, for most people who had, you know, been watching the show, it was, you know, the mads were Dr. Clayton Forrester and TV's Frank. So, like, when I mentioned this in the book briefly, that I allude to it. I did not specifically say that it was a thing that had been my personal experience, but I was watching Mystery Science Theater 3000 as a kid, just sort of stumbled upon it and sort of really enjoyed it. And then when I saw the movie, and then, you know, a different person is voicing Crow T. Robot, and there's no Pearl, but there's just Dr. Forrester. Like, I had no sort of context for that, and it was very sort of baffling to me. Because this is like, you know, I didn't have the history of the show at the time. I wasn't even aware of its Comedy Central sort of run. So that was all stuff that has been, you know, after the fact. It wasn't actually even until I decided to write this book that I saw a single episode from the first season of the show where the two Mads were Dr. Forrester and Dr. Larry Earhart, who was performed by Josh Weinstein, who was also the then voice of Tom Servo, who left the show after that first season. So that was a new experience to me sort of as well. So it's just, you know, that's basically, I think, sort of covers sort of the general gist of what this show sort of was. It was a venue for sort of a pop culture, sort of a conversation and jokes and community and sort of irony and so on and so forth, and you know, a great show that I love to this day.
Yeah, I think the first time I saw Mystery Science Theater of any sort was they used to run a shortened version for that they syndicated, and that was because I didn't have access to the comedy first Comedy Channel and then Comedy Central. It was the same network, changed names, but it wasn't on a lot of cable systems, and so they used to show small segments from the series on, you know, for an hour. And then, of course, when they showed up on Sci-Fi, I suddenly had access 100% because the cable system happened to have Sci-Fi channels. So, of course, I'm in some ways like you in that most of what I remember from my initial memory was the Sci-Fi period. But even by then, they were coming out with videotapes of the legal ones, not even the trading ones. But legal ones where you could see, I think the first one they came out with was like The Brain Who Wouldn't Die, and a few other ones where you could actually see the originals. And of course, we know today the DVDs are still incredibly popular and are selling quite well for Shout Factory, who's the company behind the current re-release of them. Of course, the show depended on having the best bad movies. That's how, you know, because you had to have bad movies to talk about, or for the characters to talk about. How did they decide what films to riff? What was the process they had to go through?
Well, it was, you know, obviously they'd find a lot of films, and they would be sent a lot of films, and films would be packaged sort of together, and they're in different sort of, because a lot of those sort of old cheap B sort of movies would sort of be packaged together to be sold to be aired during like sort of the horror host sort of shows that be showed locally. So, and then, you know, they could just get access to those, and then they'd have to be watched and screened. And Frank Conniff, who portrayed TV's Frank on the show, was, when he was on the show, in charge of being the guy who would first watch these movies to see if it felt worthy of riffing, if it would sort of be appropriate for riffing in terms of like the content, how much they'd have to cut out or what have you. Because in an early instance with the movie Side Hackers, which is an old sort of B-movie biker film, which those kind of films tend to be particularly sort of violent and grotesque, and a character suffered a pretty particularly gruesome sort of unpleasant ending, and they just had to completely excise that from the film after they decided to do it. And it was sort of like, it became a sort of like clunky sort of transition for them. They just had to sort of announce that the character was now dead and no longer in the film. And so from that point on, they became sort of more careful about it. And then that was, I presume, it can continue to be the process, is that somebody would have to screen a bunch of movies to see if they would sort of fit into the show. And then I presume then the process would begin of, you know, watching it over and over and over again to come up with the riffs to put into the finished product.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the things that, as I first learned more and more, that surprised me, that, well, not surprised, but I could see now, that's that the shows were written down. I mean, they were fully scripted. There was not any, this was not something where they were improvising. They had written everything word for word, and So you can imagine what kind of work was necessary to bring everything together, to put together something that at first glance, when you first listen to it, sounds like a bunch of guys sitting around their living room making fun of something that's on television.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, on sort of that, I actually, perhaps unsurprisingly, given my affinity for the show, have done a little bit of sort of writing riff sort of things for little sort of internet things or what have you. And I remember like my first time doing it, you think, because like the idea in your head is somebody like you when you're sitting at home and you're watching a movie, you think of a couple of funny quips you throw out there, and it doesn't seem as too daunting. But I remember first sitting down to watch something with the intent of needing jokes for the riffing process on just a short, and it felt so like overwhelming. I kept feeling like I like can't keep up, like in terms of like, because things would come at you so fast, and when you have that actual notion in your mind and have that actual plan in your mind, it's not just like an organic process. So I mean, that's why they had to do it. So I mean, they did it so many times. Eventually, it's going to slow down. Eventually, you're going to memorize sort of the dialogue, and it also helps when it's a movie that's perhaps more slower paced, because then you get, you know, it's not as hard to sort of follow, and also helps because that way you don't have to worry so much about talking over dialogue. Like, you have spaces to fill with your various riffs. But I can say from personal experience, that first time when you sort of sit down to watch something with the intent of riffing on it, it's a pretty daunting experience.
Yeah, I know what you mean. You can sort of tell, well, especially in the early seasons where they were, or especially the first season, some of the early episodes, there would be long periods of time with nothing, you know, with just dialogue from the movie going on, and then suddenly they'd come in every once in a while. And as the seasons went on, we started to get films where it was almost nonstop sometimes as far as how much they were doing. And I suspect you can see that change. And somebody who'd never seen any, like The Crawling Eye, which was the first episode that was aired on, you know, on regular cable, if you watched it today and you only knew the later episodes, I could imagine it might have. It definitely seems a little bit strange because there's these long periods of time where it's just dialogue and they're not saying much of anything.
Yeah, and there's also they did in the early days, the KTMA days, which was the station in Minnesota, it was a little bit more sort of improvisational And you can also sort of tell because it's even like sort of slower, and that sort of improvisational ishness sort of kind of goes into that early first season, like in the Crawling Eye episode. I remember watching it. You can sort of see at times the people in the theater sort of stumbling over each other, interrupting each other a little bit. Whereas in later seasons, when things were much, you know, more fully written, they could do extended bits with, you know, perfect sort of alacrity without any sort of issue because it was all written down. And that was, you know, a smart move. That was, you know, an obvious part of the process, the learning process of, you know, creating television, developing television. It was they could not have obviously sustained a model of, you know, even sort of a partial improvisation. It just never would have really worked for the long term.
Let's start to talk about some of the specific films that you talk about in the book. You did 12, right? There's 12 films that you discussed in the whole. You didn't just discuss the film and how that was riffed, but basically the entire episode to see how everything sort of fit together. The first one you started with was Gamera, but not the original, not the one that most people probably have seen, which is when it was done for Comedy Central, but from the original KTMA episode. And you talk a lot, and pretty critical, and for good reason, and talk about how different this was to what even the final version of Gamera that was televised later. But did you see much in the version that you reviewed that could show that the series could be a success?
Well, not really, actually. I mean, it was interesting mostly as an anthropological sort of thing, like the early days of the show. But that episode in particular was fascinating. The reason I ended up choosing that one was because it was a movie they had redone, and also it was because Gamera was sort of a fairly well-known kaiju character, made a lot of Gamera movies and what have you. But by sort of serendipity, it also was a perfect sort of exemplar of the sort of constraints and issues with making, you know, cheap local access UHF television, because when they're making that particular episode of Trace and Josh, who portrayed Crow, and Tom were both unable to be there when they were doing the riffing in the theater, just because simply this wasn't their full time work. It was so they had to be elsewhere. So in the theater, when they're doing the riffing, it's just Joel, and so it's one man improvising riffs, and it is just the slowest of going, and it was, I mean, like, and like the riffs are not, I mean, it's very sort of basic stuff that, well, people think of, like, people riffing movies, like talking about, like, oh, that looks cheap, or oh, that character did something dumb. It's a lot more of that as opposed to the much more sort of elaborate, clever, reference heavy stuff that would become. Like, this is very much, it's very primitive. And there is some elements of humor that were more obvious in the host segments around the movie. But when you see just Joel sitting in that theater watching Gamera by himself making the occasional comment, I would never have looked at that and said, this is going to become one of the most sort of inventive, brilliant, and hilarious shows in the history of television.
Yeah, I think number one, as you point out, I think part of it was that he was by himself. I've never heard of the concept that if you're going to make fun of something, you've got to hope that there's other, you need an audience, and we're not just talking about the television audience. It's when you have a few people together. And in fact, on a lot of the episodes that I've watched, you can sort of see the progression that it's always in the same order of who has a line. And when somebody's doing it all by themselves, I can see how that could be really used the word. I mean, I don't know if you used the word deadly, but it was pretty close to that. And as you say, they redid it, and it's just unbelievable how the Gamera that they later did. And it's now available, you know, as part of the DVD sets, how different they were able to make it.
I think they actually, the DVD set, I feel like they put all the Gameras together.
Yeah, they
for
did.
A DVD set. Yeah, because they did several of those.
And of course, the good thing about Gamera is because there are characters that are in all of, you know, there's a certain, I think it's Kenny, he's the boy, he's in them regularly, so they can always refer back where and it becomes a running part of the running gags of the series that they can talk about him, and it is an interesting way. And of course, the KTMA episodes aren't even officially available in any way, shape, or form, and I suspect we know why. I don't think anybody really wants them to be seen officially. So let's move on now to Pod People. And this is one of the ones that came out on videotape when the series was still going on. But I also found it to be one of the best ones because it was a good example of how they would come up with catchphrases that they would use regularly throughout a movie and sometimes into later movies. And of course, the one in this case for Pod People is "It Stinks," which actually was dubbed. I think the original film, it was dubbed over from a foul language, but he holds up his OK sign and says, "It stinks," and they start using that pretty regularly throughout the film. What did you see was so special about Pod People?
Well, Pod People, I was really I had that VHS too. It was probably one of my first exposures to the Joel era. And when I was doing a different interview and promoting my book, and somebody asked like if you were going to recommend episodes to people or episode to somebody who hadn't seen the show before, I recommended a Joel and a Mike one. The Joel one I recommended was Pod People because I think it is one of the best episodes of the show. It is because it's sort of ideal because the movie they're riffing on, Pod People, is truly mind-bogglingly atrocious, but in a way that is really funny. It's part horror film, part E.T. ripoff, and it's just really sort of a great synthesization of like what makes the show so good, like in the various different running jokes and the host segments, like when they, because you mentioned the whole "It Stinks" thing. It's after this sort of musician in the movie sings this sort of a terrible song, and then they do a host segment where it's Joel singing the song sort of ostensibly, but with, you know, sort of nonsense lyrics. And when they cut to the down in Deep 13 where Dr. Forrester and TV's Frank are, and they're taking on the role of like the producers, and Frank's wearing the "I'm a Virgin" shirt that the guy in the movie is wearing. It's like, it's one of the sort of best, funniest sort of host segments that they've done. It's just a great episode. It's not necessarily monumental in any sort of sense of like, you know, a big sort of epic turn in the show, like when a character left or whatever. It's just really a great choice of movie combined with some great riffing, and it just makes it a really wonderful, hour and a half of television.
Yeah, I think you hit it right on the head. I think by this point they were really hitting their stride, so to speak, doing some really good work, and they were working together so well that by this point a movie like Pod People, just as you point out, it was just a perfect example. And it doesn't really, you know, it's the kind of thing where if somebody didn't see the series at all beforehand, they would still get it, and I suspect you're right, they'd be laughing at it pretty well. Well, just for interest, what was the Mike episode you suggested in that interview?
I want to say that I recommended Werewolf because it's one of my favorite episodes, and it's also one that you can sort of just jump into. I feel like I probably went with Werewolf because it, like I said, it's like, you know, pretty. It's a not as funnily bad of a movie, although it is a bad movie, but I just think it's got some really funny riffs in it. I love the bit where Mike and the Bots do the girl group song about the werewolf, and it's just, I feel like that's probably the one I went with because it's one of my favorite episodes, so that's probably a good bet off the top of my head for what I went with.
Of course, one of the other films I wanted to make sure we discussed was Manos, The Hands of Fate, because most of the time anybody who is a fan of the series will usually point to that movie, that episode, as being one of the best of the series. And of course, it's usually considered one of the worst films ever made. What was your thoughts on Manos, and did it make a good, perfect combination between great riffing and great writing and a really bad movie?
The Manos episode is a great episode, although I don't know if it's quite as great as some other episodes. The reason that it is a iconic episode is not so much for what MST3K brought to it, but because Manos, The Hands of Fate is quite possibly, honestly, truthfully, the worst movie I've ever seen. It is staggeringly, bizarrely poorly made in terms of like everything about it. And I went sort of into the story of the movie in the book. And it's a story that's got a little too much depth to it. And you know, I don't mean, you know, as cheap as a play as it may be to be like, hey, you know, the story's in the book. So if you're interested in the full story, it's in the book. It's a completely amateur filmmaker making a film that is amateurish by amateur filmmaking standards. It's just fascinating, but it's also sort of endearing in that sense of the, it's sort of like what people like a movie like that documentary American movie. It's, you know, like what people like the concept of Ed Wood as put out by the Tim Burton movie Ed Wood, as opposed to the actual Ed Wood, who's just sort of like a cheap, sleazy filmmaker, as opposed to sort of the idealist, naive that he is in the Tim Burton movie. But the movie is so bad, this episode was sort of destined to become iconic, just because even though this is a show that is built on riffing bad movies, to find the movie this poor is a true feat, and that makes it a very memorable episode. It's a very funny episode too. It is an enjoyable episode, and it introduced Torgo into the lexicon of Mystery Science Theater 3000. He is the master of the movie. He's like the kind of sense of a main villain. He's the henchman, this strange character that the guy who did the performance has a very sort of bafflingly bizarre sort of avant-garde performance, and that sort of Torgo became a piece of the Mystery Science Theater 2000 puzzle based on that fact. But it is definitely an episode. But it's like when I was talking about episodes I'd recommend people seeing for the first time, I definitely would not recommend Mandos, because it is very too much of a potentially alienating experience for people who are not sort of actively interested and engaged in the show, and particularly in bad movies, because this movie is at times even sort of like challenging. Even with the help of the people from Mystery Science 3000, I couldn't imagine trying to watch this movie without them. It would be really bizarre and probably unpleasant experience.
Yeah, I know I've read interviews in which they've discussed some of the films they chose, and the whole idea of, okay, do you want to have a movie that is so bad that people don't even want to see the movie and therefore will ignore it? There's been, you know, this Manos definitely qualifies as one of the worst. Of course, one of the other ones that I always think of was far one of the worst ever made, which of course they did not riff, was Plan 9 from Outer Space. Although they did do Robot Monster, which is another one that has a reputation as being such a terrible movie, but they did do Robot Monster. But I agree. I can see how Manos, because the movie is so strange, that will people sit through it if they're not already invested in the whole MST3K concept.
Yeah.
So, of course, you also made sure to get Mitchell in your book. Of course, that was the famous or infamous transition episode from Joel to Mike. It was Joel's last episode as host and Mike's first. Although Mike had appeared in various other episodes as, you know, side characters and things. This was when he took over, or at the end actually takes over. He's just in the background for much of it. But it's also a very good episode. It's another one where you could watch it and you're just going to laugh at it because it's so well done. But did you think they did a good job in transitioning from one host to the other with Mitchell?
In terms of like, this is like the episode, like a lot of time the host segments are just sort of like little goofy things, occasionally riffing on the movie, occasionally not, just to sort of like little comedy sketches to sort of break up the potential monotony of watching a bad movie. Whereas in this episode, there's actually a little bit of a story going on, because there's the whole, because they need to have, you need to do something to get Joel out and to replace him with Mike, and they didn't want to just do it arbitrarily. So there's a whole sort of story going on about Gypsy's worried that, you know, the bads are going to kill Joel, so she's got to save Joel, and she helps, so she's got to make a plan to help Joel escape, and he ends up escaping in a machine appropriately called the Deus Ex Machina, which has been kept in a box of ham dingers. And then, you know, so he's able, there's a whole actual almost sort of arc of narrative going through it that's, you know, it's funny, but it's also, you know, well done, and it justifies, you know, why Joel is leaving and how Joel is leaving, while also sort of hanging a lampshade on the fact that, like, yeah, this is a little convenient that we have this this machine, this escape pod suddenly found. And then, you know, transitioning the mic, fair enough, in terms of, like, you know, having him be there, and obviously then, you know, it still was going to be, you know, a change, and there was going to be some issues with that. And there always was, and there always will be sort of debates between Joel versus Mike in terms of being a host. But in terms of actually making that transition, I feel like they did about as clever as the way as they were going to manage, considering the fact they were not a narrative first show.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, but as I say, it also helped that the film, you know, Mitchell just was perfect. I don't know. I didn't get a chance to don't notice. I know that Mitchell, Joe Don Baker had knew about MST3K and I don't think he was a major fan, so to speak. And I think what they did with Mitchell probably had a lot to do with that, because he doesn't come through it very well as far as being how they treated him.
That one's actually kind of sort of interesting, because it's one of the more sort of professionally made movies that's been on the show, with a lot of sort of notable actors, including Joe Don Baker, who was in Walking Tall and some other films. And so it's interesting in that sense, because it's like, you know, it's not a good movie, but it's not like one of the bizarre sort of cheap out of left field sort of horror movies or monster movies that they've done, and that it's actually sort of got a professional sheen to it, which I feel like helps every now and then to have a movie that has some recognizable people and that's got at least an air of competence to it if you're going to be, you know, picking it apart and what have you.
Yeah, no, they were in some cases they were forced to hit movies that, you know, use movies that were, you know, dubbed Italian movies or other from foreign movies that were brought over to the United States and dubbed. And sometimes those movies where you don't really know who anybody is in the film, I can see how that makes for a little bit more, you know, could be more troublesome when they're trying to do their work, where Mitchell worked out so perfectly. So MST3K is one of those television shows that actually made a movie and then, of course, went back to television again. But you have a whole chapter about the movie, about the film, and I agree with what you say in it. I mean, it wasn't a successful I mean, if it was even a television episode, it wouldn't be considered one of the more successful ones. But what was the film they chose for the project, and why do you think? What were the problems that they ran into when they made it that it didn't really succeed?
Well, the film that they chose to show in the movie, because the movie is just basically like the TV show. Like I said, it's basically an episode of the TV show made into a movie, but sort of counterintuitively, it's actually shorter than most episodes of the TV show. The movie that they show is This Island Earth, which is a film which has, in terms of notable actors, Russell Johnson, who played the professor on Gilligan's Island, which leads to a variety of jokes, obviously, related to Gilligan's Island, the professor. But it's sort of it feels like a good choice for a movie, because it's a nice sci-fi movie with some cheap-looking costumes, some ridiculous-looking aliens, a sort of a traditional bland, you know, all-American lead, and it would have been perfectly fine as an episode of TV. But the fact that they tried to put this into a film, as it's basically just like an episode of the movie. Or an episode of the show, I should say, but with longer and better shot and more technically rich interstitial sort of host segments. And they got to show a few other segments of the satellite. I love the ship. And that's kind of cool, I guess, but it was a strange sort of fit. It's good. It's enjoyable. It's Mr. Shazier 3000. But then when they turned it into a film, trying to take an idea that's sort of idiosyncratic and turning it into a film, I don't know if it was the necessarily best idea in general. And then when they made the film, they decided to release it in road movie fashion, which is to say they went from like city to city with the movie and showed it there for a little while, so no word of mouth ever really got a chance to build, and they would sort of move on. So the movie was largely a disaster at the box office, because they decided to do that for whatever reason, and this was never a thing that was going to get anybody who wasn't a fan of the show to show up anyways. Because like I remember like seeing ads for it on TV when the movie came out, and it's like if you had no clue and you're seeing these little robot silhouettes making jokes while another movie's playing, it's, you know, it's a hard sell. And so the movie was, well, you know, in terms of content was, you know, fine. It was a funny episode of Mr. Shazier 3000 that was shown in movie theaters. But in terms of actually the concept and execution of it as a movie in terms of marketing and distribution, it was really pretty much a failure. And, you know, it sort of disabused him of the notion of ever doing something like that again.
I think part of the other thing, and this is one of the things that you mentioned earlier with the bad guys, sort of in this case, the mad scientists. In this case, there was only, you know, it was only Dr. Forrester. He was the only. So I, in my opinion, that's part of the thing that, you know, he had nobody to bounce off of, where what was so great with the earlier seasons was you always had two people, you know, Dr. Forrester and then, you know, most of the time TV's Frank. And it really did make for a better way to have two characters talking to each other. And in this case, when it was just Dr. Forrester, it sort of made it more static. You know, there was, but you're right. It was interesting that they had the opportunity to spruce everything up. But I thought part of the charm of the series was everybody knew everything was just sort of, you know, done on the fly seemingly and put together the way it was. Where here they really, it just seemed like that was not really necessary for what they were really trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
So then it was soon after the film that they moved to Sci-Fi Channel. What did you think? One of the big differences with the Sci-Fi Channel is that most of the films always were pretty much all either science fiction, horror, those kind of things, fantasy, as opposed to the original seasons where you would occasionally get like Mitchell, which was like a police film or a crime film. What were one or two of the Sci-Fi Channel episodes that you thought were particularly good for that segment of the series?
Well, one of them is a movie that I put in the book and probably rivals Manos in terms of badness of the movie, and that's Hobgoblins, which is a really weird, poorly made, sort of kind of gremlinish ripoff that is very much dated to the 80s. The sort of the Hobgoblins are these real cheap looking puppets. And it's just, that movie's probably more laughably bad than Manos the Head of Fate. It's not as technically incompetent of a movie, but in terms of being funny in its badness, it's probably the funniest movie in and of itself that was ever on Mystery Science Theater 3000. And that led to a lot of sort of really excellent sort of riffing opportunities, just because there's so much fodder within that movie for making fun of. Like, it's a movie that if you were watching it by yourself, you could probably get, if you were the kind of person who is interested in watching bad movies for the sake of it, you could get a lot of enjoyment out of it just because of how bad it is itself. But having, you know, Mystery Science Theater 3000 treatment only takes it to another level. So that's definitely high up there. Werewolves from That Time, I already mentioned that one. There's actually quite a few good movies that came during the sci-fi era, or good episodes. And they did eventually get a little more sort of lenient in terms of the whole sci-fi thing. But I, off the top of my head, don't recall necessarily many particularly like notable or strong episodes that came. I mean, they showed another Joe Don Baker movie, Final Justice. The last movie they ever showed was a Italian heist movie called Diabolique, which is sort of an interesting choice for a last episode. And as much as they, like, you would think that probably it would end with something more science fiction-y, particularly being on a Sci-Fi Channel, but, you know, it is what it is there. But there's a lot of good episodes. Like, people like may think, oh, they, you know, they changed networks. Maybe the show took a step down. But there's a lot of still really funny episodes that are from the Sci-Fi Channel era.
Of course, for the last episode, when they knew it was the last episode, too, because they do give a, you know, they do end the story completely at the end. So it's probably not a surprise that their attitude was, well, we're not coming back anyway, so we might as well do whatever film we can get. Of course, one of the things that the earlier episodes had pretty regularly, but not so much in the sci-fi era, and you wrote a whole chapter about it, are the shorts. I still consider them in general to be some of my favorite parts of the show. I can watch some of them multiple times and still laugh every time, because the great thing is over the years we've gotten collections that were just shorts, and it's gotten to a point now where you watch some of them, and because I think partly because they're so short and therefore can be very specific, that makes them some of the funniest parts of the show. And sort of explain a little bit about why we were seeing shorts in the first place over time in the series, and going from that, what were some of your personal favorites as far as how they handled the shorts?
Basically the shorts came about because sometimes a movie, like particularly in the early days of B-movies, when they were literally movies that were being shown like in theaters before the A-movie, the main feature would show, they'd often be fairly short movies, sometimes like, you know, barely over an hour long, and then you have to cut some of that out for sort of like content or for time, or because it's not a lot of fodder there, and you got an episode of TV that is without commercials, like an hour and a half or so of content. And so, like, you'd have some time if you wanted to show a movie that would be particularly rich for, you know, making jokes about and riffing, but you'd had a little bit of time left over, you could stick a short in there, and these would be little short films. At first, they would show parts of old movie serials, which were like these little short films that would, again, in the sort of the old school era, when you're going to a movie theater, was a major experience where there'd be like, you know, a serial, a B movie, an A movie, the main feature, and so on and so forth. They started with these, like Phantom Creeps with Bela Lugosi and Radar Men on the Moon, but then eventually they transitioned into what people think of primarily when they think of the shorts, in both in the show and in general, which were like little short films that were usually educational, like things trying to teach children about cheating or like proper posture, or like sort of industrial shorts about the chicken of tomorrow or so on and so forth, or things that were selling things. Like this is a nice way to transition to my favorite of all the shorts, which is Mr. B Natural, which is a show that was made by a musical instrument company. I believe it's Con Instruments was the company who did it. It's a very bizarre, almost sort of nightmarish film about this sprightly gentleman, Mr. B. Natural, who is played by a woman in sort of Peter Pan style, who shows up, gives a very like off-putting sort of performance as this sort of a musical manifestation who is teaching a boy the joys of musical instruments. And it's just really weird and sort of like off-putting, but really funny, and, you know, it gives obviously plenty of fodder in that sense. Another short similar to that is the a short that was A Case of Spring Fever, which is somehow basically a movie saying that springs are good, which is it's reminiscent of a bit they did on an episode of The Simpsons, wherein Lisa's class was watching a movie about the importance of zinc, and it's the same premise of like, he wishes there'd be no springs in his life, and then he sees a world without springs. And this fact combined with this you know, bit of The Simpsons leads me to believe that these are probably an inordinate amount of these sort of little short films that were expressing the unseen value of things people were taking for granted or what have you. But it's just a very strange film that has this little animated sprite of springs, and it's another very sort of strange one. And there's some other good sort of industrial ones, a couple good ones about college. There's a couple of them that are about like being in love or romance. It's like a lot of, you know, scolding of teenagers and so on and so forth to try and teach people the right way to live as per the examples put forth by the people who, you know, make industrial short educational films.
Yeah, I think a few of them were actually like even Mr. B Natural, it really is nothing more than a commercial for the company that produced it. They keep pushing their own instruments and so on, and I think that's the way with some of the other ones, as you point out. Some were more meant to be educational, such as the ones that were produced by a company called Coronet, which they did quite a few of. But some of them are really nothing more than commercials, and it is interesting to see how the products that were actually being advertised were sort of stuck in the middle in parts. But I don't know, I thought the use of the shorts, there were times where the short was for me the best part of a particular episode. And so I'm glad that I do believe they are still some of the more popular aspects of, there's been a couple other books written with essays about Mystery Science Theater 3000. And each of the two books that I've seen makes sure that there's at least one chapter that discusses the shorts. And I think that was probably one of the reasons. So why does Mystery Science Theater 3000 still hold up? I know it's probably an impossible question to ask, but I think it's worth discussing. Shout Factory, which, as I mentioned, is the current publisher of the DVD sets. They're coming out with new sets on a regular basis, and now you can watch episodes through Netflix and some of the other digital platforms. Why is Mystery Science Theater still popular?
Well, I mean, the facile way to begin the answer would be to say it because it was great. It was really good, really funny, and well made. But beyond that, it's also very sort of idiosyncratic in terms of, like, there's not anything that's really come to replace it, and anything that has sort of kind of stepped into that Mystery Science Theater 3000 shadow is like a Riff Trax or a Cinematic Titanic, which are two things that were made by the Mystery Science Theater 3000 people. There's been sort of pale imitators, sure, but nothing with this sort of level of competence or quality. And so, like, if you are interested in sort of the highest order of film riffing, and, you know, Mystery Science Theater 3000 is pretty much the only place to go. Oh, and it's sort of also a internally perpetually it's a thing that people are always going to sort of have an interest in. It can't really ever necessarily get, because a good movie may seem dated, and that would be a negative, but a bad movie getting dated only adds to the quality of the experience in sort of a backwards way. And the sort of, like you said, the lo-fi aesthetics of the show that were always there and part of the endearing quality of the show, they don't have a negative impact as the show ages, because it always had that sort of look and always had that quality. The sort of people who were a fan of it had, probably people had a sort of an affinity, like you said, for that sort of lo-fi style. So it basically built itself in such a way that it would always feel sort of necessary and could never really go out of style, just because there's nothing about it that really could do that. Like, people making jokes about movies and pop culture is sort of internally repeating sort of thing. So it's just, and it's the, like, still to this day, the pinnacle of that sort of a genre, so to speak. So that's why I feel like it remains popular, is because, you know, people will always have an interest in this, and there's nobody who has come to really, you know, challenge for that throne to this date.
So what other projects, do you have other book projects you're still working on, or you're just going back to your regular writing, or do you have some more Mystery Science Theater 3000 ideas in mind?
Well, I am in the early stages of the same publisher. Hopefully this will come together. It's not official yet, but it's far enough along. I don't mind mentioning it, that I'm working on putting together a book that would be sort of for people who are fans of Mystery Science 3000, probably will have an interest in this as well, sort of a encyclopedic book about the various local horror hosts from across the country throughout history. Horror hosts, people who would host shows, or they would host these little evening midnight movie features in their local networks with their various different guises of characters, and they would introduce the movies. People probably are familiar with maybe Elvira, probably the most famous of these. Vampira, sort of the initial person who did this way back in the 50s, who appeared in the movie Planet from Outer Space, sort of tie that back in there. I'm working on sort of that, and it's in the early sort of stages of that. And beyond that, just my traditional sort of writing things I'm doing, and, you know, still doing the Existential Parachute Pants stuff. I'm working on some other things that aren't sort of necessarily far enough along to really get into, but I guess, you know, if people would be interested in the horror host book or this book or anything I'm working on, there's always information to be found at my Twitter, which is at Chris X Morgan. And, you know, in this modern era, people like me who are writers, like, when you're doing something, you could find it on the Twitter.
That's how I found you. That's how I got a hold of you. It was the easiest way to find you. Of course, speaking of movie hosts, horror movie hosts, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. And of course I was Goulardi. Around when Goulardi started, was going on, and It was a very short period of time that he actually did the show, but that was probably, for me at least, the best example I could think of. And for somebody who started that way, and then Ernie Anderson, who played Gullardi, ended up with an incredible voiceover career, that it was just unbelievable how successful he became, starting off, like you say, as a monster movie host.
Yeah. And of course, he's the father of the acclaimed director Paul Thomas Anderson.
Right. So, that's an interesting project because, like you say, there were a lot of them, and it's not something we see anymore, because local television stations don't really show movies the same way they used to back then. As you pointed out earlier, it was a matter of they had to fill up a lot of time sometimes, and especially at night and in the evenings when you had this period of time to fill. And even during the afternoon, we had different hosts, but they weren't monster hosts. They were more just a person would come on and do a quiz and things and try to get people to stay on and continue to watch the films. But nowadays, that's not something that we have in any way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's great. I found the book very good. I really enjoyed reading about some of the background and your critiques, because I think that's the key thing. I mean, the people who are real MST3K fans, they like talking about and writing about the episodes and the way they came through to them. And I think you did a really great job of presenting your views, but also some of the background information that I think gives it even more interest as far as understanding the series. And glad we had this conversation. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Chris Morgan for talking with me. I hope you will check out his podcast, Existential Parachute Pants. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more new books in film.